เหรียญ
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Foodcom International versus Barry. Mr. Greenell?
May it please the court, thank you for hearing this case on an expedited basis. Illinois law favors both freedom of employment and freedom of competition. The trial court's ruling below impinges on both. Even when a non-compete agreement exists, Illinois courts enforce it reluctantly and narrowly. I cite to you, for example, the Advent Electronics versus Buckman case stating that proposition. Here, however, there was no non-compete agreement, but the trial court nevertheless entered a broad injunction restraining the defendants from working for the employer of their choice and from competing with plaintiffs. It did so because the defendants merely contacted a prospective employer while still working for their current employer. The trial court found this as a breach of fiduciary duty, even though the case law in Illinois and elsewhere throughout the country suggests and consistently holds that defendants were engaged merely in permissible preparations to compete. Based solely upon the submission by defendants Lacey and Barry of a business plan, a plan which was later abandoned to Empire, the trial court found they breached their fiduciary duties by usurping a corporate opportunity and by actually competing with Foodcom. These findings were errors of law. I suggest we talk about the redistribution proposal and the usurpation of it first. As you recall, the redistribution proposal was an idea between Empire, a third party at the time, and Foodcom. It incorporated a unique price mechanism whereby the two parties would share the risk of this frozen meat that was on the seas. The trial court found that opportunity was usurped by our clients. We have given you five reasons as to why that ruling was in error. First, the usurpation doctrine simply doesn't apply to defendants Lacey and Barry because they were merely employees and not officers and directors. The policy of the courts is that officers and directors serve as gatekeepers for the corporation. They're the ones who are best positioned to evaluate the worth of a proposal. Employees are not in that position. Plaintiff cites only two cases in which the usurpation doctrine has been applied to non-officers and directors. One of those is under Wisconsin law, the Regal Beloit case. The other, the Mulaney Wells case, was under Illinois law. But even in that case, it applied the doctrine only to an investment banker who was affiliated with a company and where the court found he had not strenuously objected to the imposition of a fiduciary duty upon him. He clearly had managerial responsibilities, and the court found that his actions were clearly within the scope of his responsibilities. Here, the evidence is undisputed that Lacey and Barry had no managerial responsibilities whatsoever, and the redistribution agreement was not within the scope of their responsibilities. To be clear on that point, they did have responsibilities for dealing with Empire in terms of selling it meat. No question about that. But the redistribution proposal was something absolutely separate and apart. Greg Bork, the officer and co-owner of Foodcom, testified that this was a unique proposal, completely new. He was the one who took responsibility for negotiating it on behalf of Foodcom. Next two reasons as to why usurpation didn't occur is there was no opportunity that Lacey and Barry could take. One, because Empire withdrew this proposal following the collapse of negotiations at this heated March 12 meeting that you've read about in our briefs. And secondly, because Foodcom then abandoned the proposal. It made no effort whatsoever to pursue it. At most, it made one telephone call to Empire following the March 12 meeting. But even then, Mr. Bork testified he made no headway whatsoever, and thereafter he gave up trying to pursue the proposal.
Are you saying they just, that because this was, in effect, abandoned, that Barry and Lacey would have an opportunity to pick something up that was no longer viable?
Because it was abandoned with knowledge of the proposal, I think you need both components, and both existed here. That's right, Your Honor.
But now, abandoned with knowledge of not that, Barry and Lacey's proposal.
Well, the Barry and Lacey's proposal had nothing to do with the redistribution proposal. It was simply a joint venture business plan that encompassed the idea of a joint venture whereby Empire would finance part of the joint venture. The redistribution proposal didn't envision a joint venture. It didn't envision financing from Empire. It was this different price mechanism to share risk. I found it useful to think of the redistribution proposal as a risk-sharing proposal. The business plan submitted by Lacey and Barry to Empire was a finance-sharing proposal.
Well, the redistribution, whatever it is, proposal, and the joint venture proposal couldn't coexist, could they?
They did coexist, and they were utterly different.
They weren't in operation at the same time.
That is correct, Your Honor. The redistribution proposal originated in October of 2001 and ended in March of 2002. The business plan was first created and sent by Lacey and Barry to Empire on May 30th of 2002.
Speaking of the business plan, didn't Barry and Lacey use FoodCom's resources to prepare the plan and negotiate the deal? And doesn't that constitute a usurpation of corporate opportunity?
I think Your Honor might be conflating a couple of issues there. To the extent that they used resources, yes, they used the email on the computer. And yes, they used cell phones provided to them. FoodCom had sent them out to Chicago. They had no housing of their own, no facilities whatsoever of their own, unlike you and me who can go back to our homes and make telephone calls. So yes, they used those resources.
Right.
Now, it was not usurpation of the opportunity. I think what Your Honor might mean is, did this constitute actual competition by using FoodCom resources? And case after case in Illinois says no, because these cases such as HydroAir, technical representative, the whole litany that we've cited to you in our briefs, say that not only can you actually solicit customers while still employed, you can even remarkably make sales to them. And the courts here find that that simply constitutes preparations to compete. Obviously, in those cases, you can read them.
Even when you're using corporate assets.
In those cases, they were using corporate assets. They were using corporate machines to turn out products that they were selling in competition with their own current employer. The theory that FoodCom raises here, I suggest, is a dangerous one. They suggest almost strict liability, that they suggest that an employee owes an absolute duty of loyalty to his employer, even if he's an at-will employee and can be terminated on a moment's notice. What they say is that if that employee does not strictly follow his employer's best interests, he is violating his duty of loyalty. They jump from there to say that, the impact of that, Your Honor, to your question, would be that if the employee so much as makes a telephone call to a prospective employer, obviously that's not in the current employer's best interest, so he's breached his duty of loyalty. I suppose even if a headhunter called in and said, "Will you be interested in moving?" and the employee did anything other than hang up or immediately contact his employer, they would consider that to be a breach of duty.
But isn't it a little different situation, because your clients actually solicited the employer's customers for their own purposes?
The word that Mr. Brubaker of Empire used was solicited. I think that's because he'd been sitting in the courtroom for 3 days listening to FoodCom's lawyer use that word over and over again, and he unfortunately picked it up. What they did was to say, call up a prospective employer, Empire, and say, "Can we do business with you?" And the prospective employer, Empire, said, "Well, maybe, send us a proposal."
Well, the fact is, the They weren't called by Empire.
No.
They were called Empire.
That's absolutely.
However you want to call it, whether you agree with solicitation or not, even though that's the words your client spoke, that was the situation.
No question. They initiated the contact, Your Honor. And I suggest that under Illinois law, it's perfectly appropriate for employees to seek to better their positions and seek new employment. And indeed, it would be a mistake for this court to impinge upon that freedom, especially of at-will employees. We're not talking officers or directors here. On that point, the problem with FoodCom's approach, they say it's almost a strict liability approach. And once they say that an employee has made what they call a willful breach, namely by doing anything outside of the current employer's best interest, they say that the court should be free to ignore a balance of harms analysis and go straight to relief, which they say should be total deterrence, which under their definition would be a permanent injunction. The net effect of their policy would be that an at-will employee who merely contacts a prospective employer would be forever barred from working for that employer. And that just isn't the policy of Illinois or of any of the cases that anybody has cited to you. Turning back to the redistribution proposal for a second, let's remember that not only was there no proposal to take because FoodCom abandoned it and Empire withdrew it, but Lacey and Berry didn't take anything, both because, as Your Honor asked, the business plan differed from the redistribution proposal, and because the business plan was abandoned. Everybody agrees it was abandoned. How can they usurp something that no longer existed? So based upon these undisputed facts, you suggest there was no usurpation. A final word on the relief. The problem with the court's order was that it's unrelated to the harm. Remember, the harm was the submission of the business plan, but the relief was an injunction against competition. The court didn't try to impose a constructive trust on the proceeds of the plan. He simply imposed an injunction without considering whether FoodCom had a legitimate business interest that that injunction would protect. The duration of the injunction was not limited. Even though the business plan was abandoned, the injunction continues today. I'll reserve my remainder. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schaller.
May it please the court, William Schaller for FoodCom. My colleague, Mr. Greenow, and I disagree on a number of legal points and certainly a number of factual points. To begin, in its monumental decisions in Carrigan versus Unity Savings, Bendel versus Stoner, and Mulaney Wells and Company versus Savage, the Illinois Supreme Court did indeed set up an absolute strict liability for any agent, whether director, officer, or in the case of Savage, an employee, when it comes to conflicts of interest and breach of fiduciary duty. The only way to escape that absolute liability is full disclosure, timely disclosure, tender of the opportunity, and finally, consent of the principal that one may take it. In answer to Judge Mannion's question, you are correct. Their venture that they proposed, aside from being basically the same as ours, was mutually exclusive to ours. It was competitive with ours. It was not possible to do both. And regardless of whether we had ever sought the redistribution opportunity, under Kerrigan and its progeny, it is perfectly clear that the defendants had an independent duty to notify us and tender to us the potential joint venture with Empire Beef. The case that actually stands for that rule is actually a decision of this court in the Grace versus E.J. Cozen case. In that decision, the late Judge Cummins, speaking for this court, laid down the rule of decision and squarely held that Mr. Kane, an employee of the plaintiff, had usurped a corporate opportunity by entering into a joint venture with a third party there, the seller of food products, ironically. That rule of decision applies here with at least as great force, if not greater force, because here, unlike there, the third party was a customer, not merely the seller, and the plaintiff here was, in fact, the seller. That is to say, in other words, Empire, as a major customer of ours, was, of course, a protectable interest under any theory of the law. With respect to the cases, especially starting with Kerrigan, in answer to Judge Williams' question, Judge Williams, you are entirely correct that Kerrigan begins with the principle that fiduciaries may not actively exploit their positions with a company, and it specifically states that a fiduciary may not use the company's facilities to pursue and promote a corporate opportunity for his own benefit. This is the plain holding of Kerrigan's progeny, Graham versus Mims, for example, Levy versus Markle Fales, for another example, E.J. McKinnon versus Gregory, for another example. Those cases hold one after another that if you use the company's personnel, time, or equipment, the defendant is stopped from denying the corporate opportunity would have belonged to the employer. That has to be the law.
What about the cases that he cites that I can't repeat them, but saying, well, they did all these things and Illinois law at least didn't say that was wrong?
Well, several responses, Judge Mann. First of all, the cases don't say that. Secondly, the kind of conduct involved in those cases that he cites, Hydroair, technical representatives, in no way, shape, or form approaches what went on here. I have argued, and I believe I'm correct in arguing, that those cases that do not represent the law of Illinois, and not surprisingly, those cases that he represents and relies upon do not cite Kerrigan, Vendo, or Mullaney, and cannot be squared, particularly with Vendo itself.
So that's the Supreme Court cases you're referring to?
Yes, sir. Yeah. And in Vendo, I think the Vendo case is especially important here because it answers virtually all of the arguments that the defense raises here. In Vendo, which was decided 10 days after Kerrigan, and both were written by Justice Schaefer, the Supreme Court of Illinois was making a very pointed message to begin. In Kerrigan, the Illinois Supreme Court entered judgment on the pleadings on appeal before the Supreme Court in favor of the plaintiff. I'm sure the court would agree that's a rare result, and that's a message. 10 days later in Vendo, Justice Schaefer went at least as far in holding several things. First, he upheld $7.3 million damage award, which was then, I believe, the largest damage award in the history of the state of Illinois. Second, Justice Schaefer squarely held that non-competes are irrelevant. A fiduciary duty claim is independent of a non-compete. Third, the case has to be understood as implicitly holding the trade secrets are completely irrelevant because the case was originally tried in the first case, in the first trial, on a trade secret theory and reversed by the appellate court at 105 Illinois Appellate Second. It was tried a second time in the Circuit Court of Kane County, appealed on that one on the non-compete. It was reversed again where the $7.3 million award was issued. It was only then that the case came before the Supreme Court of Illinois. Clearly the court was aware the trade secrets had come and gone. Clearly the court was aware that non-competes had been reversed. Clearly the court said non-competes don't matter, and I don't believe that Vendo could ever be understood as allowing the defenses put forth here that trade secrets and non-competes have any bearing whatsoever on a fiduciary duty claim.
Mr. Schaller, if there has been a usurpation of a corporate opportunity, shouldn't the preliminary injunction be aimed at restoring that opportunity or in some way speak to a preclusion of Foodcom and Empire doing business in the future? How does this injunction aid those aims?
Well, I think they aid the aims very clearly, Your Honor, in line with the Illinois Supreme Court's complete and total deterrence policy. To begin, in Winger, the Illinois Supreme Court...
That has almost a solely punitive ring then, right? Is that the underlying thrust of the Supreme Court cases? If it doesn't speak to restoration of the opportunity, and it doesn't speak to the continued business relationship, in this case between Foodcom and Empire, what other policy drives this other than the punitive nature? I'm not suggesting that that's not to be considered in some fashion, but I'm just asking you that.
Yes. To answer your question, Chief Judge Blum, first of all, it's not so much punitive as it is deterrent. These things are not supposed to happen at all. Number two, the court can never order Empire Beef to do a deal with us. But we're not suing Empire Beef for that, nor does the injunction order that relief, nor could the injunction order that relief. Right. What the injunction can do, however, is prevent the defendants from gaining their wrongful benefit. Another way to look at it, if the court wants to look at it as a protectable interest or property interest question, is that we, at least as respecting Mr. Berry and Mr. Lacey, are deemed to own the joint venture that they created and to stand in their shoes. In fact, ironically, we're better able to have grabbed it than them. We don't have their visa problems.
And that's not answerable in money damages?
No, sir. It would never be fully calculable. And I think the key thing here is to understand a point that I believe Judge Mannion was getting at, which is these are mutually exclusive situations. What has occurred here is they usurped and diverted to themselves a competitive platform that would never have existed. We would have been joint venturers with them under the law. We would have been co-shareholders in the close corporation. And as such, it's plainly the law in every state, and certainly in Illinois, that one joint venturer cannot compete against another, and neither can a closely held co-shareholder in a corporation. As a matter of fact, Chief Judge Flom, you make that exact holding in Rexford Rand versus Ansel, 58 Fed 3rd, a 1995 decision of this court. Judge Mannion is absolutely correct that these are mutually exclusive, and had we occupied that platform, how could they have competed with us? They've destroyed that platform. That may be true that we cannot restore it as to Empire Beef, but it's absolutely true they cannot now take advantage of a platform that they would never have had and from which they now want to compete. And that is what Judge Kaur did. He took them off that platform. He was right to do it. Because under the Grace case, that platform belonged to us, at least as against Barry and Lacey, and surely they cannot divert it, destroy it, and then stand on it, which I believe is the very point of the Rexford Rand case that you yourself decided. If the court was looking for protectable interest, I think the answer could be that you could say we have a property interest. Graham versus Mims, Patient Care Services versus Siegel, all of these cases describe my client as having a property interest in the corporate opportunity. But the fact of the matter is we have to understand that when there's a third party involved, we cannot get the district court ever to order that third party to deal with us where the breach of fiduciary duties against the two defendant employees, Barry and Lacey. That's fine. It's a deterrent rationale, and perhaps it will open the door for us to renegotiate with Empire. But whether Empire ever negotiates with us again is really not the point. The point is these things should not happen, and surely the point is they cannot take that platform and compete against us. Going back to some of the comments of my colleague, Mr. Greenow, no Illinois case juxtaposes at-will employment with fiduciary duties. They're irrelevant concepts. They're not related. They're non sequiturs. Number two, it is not correct that Empire Beef ever withdrew this proposal. It stalled on March 12th. And it ended there with no further discussion, and matters were to be smoothed over by Mr. Lacey thereafter. In their briefs, the defense makes a point that this was supposedly a disclosed corporate opportunity. I would go back to Judge Mannion's comment. We were certainly not ever disclosed to us that they were seeking it for themselves, and they had a duty to do just that under Kerrigan and its progeny. And in any event, it was never... I don't see why the third-party refusal of the deal fund should ever turn on whether it's disclosed or not disclosed. The point we're making here is simply this. The third-party's refusal of the deal is not a papal dispensation to go ahead and breach your fiduciary duties. Only your employer can grant that kind of relief by consenting to it. So the third-party's refusal of the deal defense is really not relevant here at all. I would also offer that on the Savage case that Mr. Greenow describes as not seriously contending that he was a fiduciary, that's plainly incorrect. If you read the Illinois Appellate Court decision at 66 Illinois Appellate 3rd, that was the major ground on which Mr. Savage had prevailed in the lower courts, that he wasn't an agent. I believe the better way to read Savage is that the Illinois Supreme Court didn't take that argument seriously, not that Mr. Savage didn't seriously press it. I think,
as far as being a fiduciary, is it Foodcom's position that Barry and Lacey were assigned the full responsibility for somehow securing or reobtaining or whatever the Empire account, and that they were exclusively assigned that and abused that assignment?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, and especially after March 12th when Mr. Lacey agreed to smooth things over. No reasonable person could have understood that to mean that he was actually supposed to secretly stab Foodcom in the back. So it is our position, as you stated, yes.
Well, they maintain that it was abandoned. They keep using that word, that Foodcom abandoned this whole project. Therefore, it was either never going to occur or someone else was going to have to do it.
I would have two answers, Your Honor. First, Mr. Burke testified that we never abandoned it, and he disagrees with Mr. Lacey's self-serving testimony. So as a factual matter, Judge Kaur easily could have resolved it in that favor. And secondly, I go back to your very first point, whether we ever knew it about it at all. As long as they got it, they had to tell us about it because it was inherently against our interest. They had to disclose it, and they certainly couldn't use our time, material, and personnel to pursue it. So it really doesn't matter, is my actual answer, but those would be my two answers. And with respect to the remedy, I think the Molex case from the Fifth Circuit is fairly instructive on this question. It actually takes the very position we take, that the corporate usurper cannot gain to grant a permanent injunction, and it's very similar on its facts. Other Illinois cases have also granted these injunctions without limitation. Elcor versus Murray by then Magistrate Judge Pallmeyer, Comedy Cottage versus Burke is yet another example, and I don't believe that we could ever have calculated our damages or ever been able to figure out what our injury was from them standing on this platform, and I think Judge Carr was fully within his discretion to make those findings in our favor, as he did on irreparable harm and inadequate remedy at law. I would close with just one final point, Your Honors, and that is this. The bench and bar of this circuit would surely be aided by this court's clear perspective on how these sorts of matters are supposed to occur. I believe this court should endorse in full everything that District Court Judge Kaur did in this case, from entering a preservation order to begin, expedited discovery, an immediate TRO, an immediate injunction order, and a broad injunction order, but narrowly tailored to this particular wrongfully acquired platform. This was the correct ruling, and he was right to say it was a breach of fiduciary duty as a matter of law, and we believe you should reject the defenses they assert as a matter of law, since they are incorrect on their face.
Mr. Schaller, this platform you speak of, is it your view that it inherent in it is confidential information?
In this particular case, it is, actually, yes, because they both were aware of the fact that Empire Beef was interested in doing a redistribution deal, and they both gained that knowledge as a result of their employment. This was not a generally broadcast public bid. So that is certainly another avenue in which to reach the exact same result, Chief Judge Flom, and you're right. That comes through E.J. McKiernan, AB, all of the cases actually use that as an alternative way to look at this. So whether it's stealing equipment, stealing materials, whether it's using information, they all lead to the same outcome. You can't do this.
But would be a fair characterization, we're speaking here more of confidential information than specific trade secrets?
Yes, sir. And Comedy Cottage versus Burke is instructive on the point, commenting that a corporate opportunity need not rise to the level of a trade secret. I apologize, I'm
no,
out of time.
No, no, you're not. Not till you have the red light. Now, you're not constitutionally mandated to use all that time, but you have a little more time.
Well, I appreciate that, Chief Judge Blum.
If the red light comes on, the trap door opens.
Yes, I do that. But in any event, obviously, Mr. Greenough and I are both students of this area. It's very critical that you advise us how to do these things. We all need to advise our clients. My view is this kind of conduct should never occur, and you should follow Judge Cudahy's warning to that effect in Light versus Engel. Thank you. We ask that you affirm.
Thanks, Chairman. Mr. Greenough.
Thank you.
And can you deal with this Vendo case? How do you distinguish that case?
Vendo didn't even address the preparations to compete argument, and the cases that we've cited that came after it do deal with the preparations to compete. And case after case says you're allowed to prepare to compete. Indeed, Mr. Schauer, in the article that he cites to you, Disloyalty and Distrust, says that, and I quote, the preliminary stages rule, by that he was referring to preparations to compete, is alive and well in the first and second districts of the Illinois Appellate Court and elsewhere throughout the nation. Even he recognized in his article that this law is good law. Remember, his title is Disloyalty and Distrust, the Eroding Fiduciary Duties. When he asked you for guidance, he's trying to hold back the tide of Illinois opinions that favor employee mobility and favor competition. And I don't blame him for struggling on behalf of his clients, but he is fighting the tide. He says things like, these things are not supposed to happen. Well, these things, Your Honors, are simply one set of employees, two employees, seeking to better themselves by seeking new employment. That happens all the time, and the court should encourage it. And they shouldn't say, oh, you can't use the phone to do that or email, because that will have a remarkable impact on the mobility of employees. when Mr. Schaller talks about this wrongfully acquired platform, I hope you will ask yourself, wait a sec, just what is that platform?
Well, how would you describe it? That's what I was inquiring of Mr. Schaller.
Good, because Mr. Schaller did a very nice job, as he did before the trial court, of combining two platforms, namely the redistribution proposal, which was one platform, which he can't claim we took because it had this price mechanism, and looked through the briefs, looked through the record, and I apologize if you have to do that, but that had nothing to do with our business plan. We didn't take this redistribution proposal. So the other platform was our business plan setting up a joint venture. Well, if today he is suggesting that that was a corporate opportunity that we usurped, that is the first time that this court has been advised of that theory, and the first time that I've been advised of that theory, and the trial court was never confronted with that idea. All that these folks did was propose how to do business. And remember, either platform didn't exist. The business plan was abandoned. You can't usurp something that doesn't exist. When Mr. Schaller, in his article, says that even when employees win these lawsuits, they really lose when one considers the exorbitant expense inherent in protracted litigation, he's right. My clients have already lost by having to fight their way through this case and by being enjoined already for 3 months. His article suggests a Head Start injunction is all that's appropriate in these cases. The Head Start is already over. At most, they were involved for 3 months from May 30 to August 30 at FoodCom, and that 3 months has long since expired in terms of the time they've been enjoined. Thank you for your attention, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Greenhouse. Thanks to all counsel. The case is